listeners. This is Carolyn Yeager, bringing you the third installment of the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau, 1939-1945, a book written by Alfred de Zayas from the surviving files of this bureau. In this program, I'm going to read chapters 5 and 6. Chapter 5 is titled, The Testimony of Witnesses. Because an examination of the methods employed in obtaining witness testimony is essential in assessing the degree of credibility that may be assigned to the protocols found in the records of the War Crimes Bureau, this chapter attempts to test the reliability of the protocols in three ways. 1. How did the definitive text of the depositions emerge? 2. Did the questions of the examining judge contribute to increased precision and relevancy, or did they influence the testimony in a particular direction? 3. According to what criteria did the judges themselves evaluate the credibility of the witnesses? The author has interviewed some 300 former military judges and witnesses and given them copies of the depositions taken more than 40 years ago. These persons almost invariably remember the events and could describe the proceedings. From their statements, it appears that the method of taking depositions was uniform throughout the war. One former judge, Rudolf Albrecht, explained it as follows. Quote, "First of all, I let the witness describe the events. Then I dictate his statement in his presence to the clerk. After finishing dictation, I read the protocol to the witness and ask him whether his statement has been correctly recorded. If he confirmed it, I then asked him whether he consented to the content of the protocol. If so, the protocol was then submitted to him for his signature." Unquote. Former Army Judge Otto Mackel described the sequence in greater detail. Now here's what Otto Mackel has written. "Depositions of witnesses were carried out in a very exhaustive and cautious manner. The witness was questioned a first time before giving his statement to protocol, and only after he said, 'This is correct, so I can swear to it,' would the attestation proceed. A deposition took, in the typical case, about 2 hours. The clerk was present during the deposition and sat at his typewriter ready, so that the protocol was dictated to him in presence of the witness, who at all times could speak out. The witness could make corrections throughout. Then the protocol was read to him another time, and he signed it under V.G.U., that is, read, approved, and signed, and then followed the oath, all of this in the presence of the persons involved in the deposition. Thereupon, the examining judge and the clerk also signed the protocol." End of statement by Judge Otto Mackel. The next section is headed Interrogation and Administration of the Oath. As in every legal system, it was prohibited for judges to influence the witnesses or to manipulate the testimony in a particular direction. Still, as every lawyer knows, precise questions on legally relevant facts must be posed to ensure that tangential or unimportant information is not also recorded. In order to determine which facts or events are relevant to the investigation, the judge must hear the witness out and let him describe in detail the course and circumstances of the occurrence. But the judge must also probe for those key facts of legal significance of which only he can appreciate. Many German parachutists, for instance, complained of Allied violations of the laws of war in Crete, 1941. They alleged that they had been shot at while still in the air and, quote, defenseless, unquote. Judge Stegemeyer had to explain to them that shooting at parachuting soldiers is a legitimate act of war. Moreover, many of the parachutists were not at all defenseless, but were already shooting at the ground forces during their descent. The Bureau, endeavoring to avoid a flood of protocols, pursued a policy of having only those witnesses questioned who reported genuine violations and who could deliver legally relevant evidence. This is why the military judges were requested to pose very precise questions so as to ferret out the legally significant facts. Many reports from the Italian theater of war accused Anglo-American flyers of bombarding or machine-gunning German hospitals and hospital trains. On 28 April 1944, the commander of Army Group C forwarded a list of reported cases to the High Command's operations staff and commented, quote, "In spite of the general rise in the number of air attacks in the month of April, it appears that attacks on medical facilities and ambulances have increased at a greater pace than the prevailing proportion would have led us to expect," unquote. The Bureau asked the military courts to pursue specific aspects of these reports. They said, quote, "For the intended documentary evaluation of the deposition, it is important to know the degree of visibility, the height from which the bombardment took place, the position and size of the Red Cross markings, and most importantly, whether the medical facilities at the time of the attack were clearly and recognizably separated from military objectives," unquote. Following these guidelines, the military judges were able to sort out the reports and to reject a number of them as unjustified. Quote, "No violation of the Geneva Convention is discernible in the case of 20th March 1944, because both vehicles had just been turned over to the unit and owing to lack of red paint had not yet been marked with red crosses. The vehicles were on the way to Perugia for repairs where the Red Cross markings would have been painted on them," unquote. In other cases, the Bureau's own research revealed that some allegations did not, in fact, involve violations. These cases were sorted out and not used either in official white papers or in diplomatic notes of protest. On 12 December 1944, for instance, the Bureau communicated to the Navy High Command that, quote, "the attack of U.S. bombers on the hospital ship Stuttgart at Gotenhafen on 9 September 1943, was not included in the enclosed list because the Stuttgart, as indicated by the Naval War Staff on 23rd October 1943, was camouflaged on the seaside with sackcloth and therefore did not enjoy the protection of the Hague Convention of 18 October 1907, even though there were Red Cross markings on deck," unquote. The Bureau showed itself similarly skeptical about the relatively frequent allegations of the shooting at shipwreck crews and always pursued the question of whether the shooting had actually been directed at the survivors and whether there was any other military objective nearby that would have justified the shelling. In order to testify the credibility of witnesses, some military judges resorted to posing trick questions. One such judge was Gerhard Wulle, W-U-L-L-E. "I still remember quite well my depositions of Private Haas and non-commissioned officer Kirchner on 26 August 1940 and 7 January 1942 because the events they described very much affected me. Quite importantly, I did not have the impression that either of them was giving a black and white picture of the events. They had been simply too deeply shocked. Furthermore, I tested their credibility, as I usually do, by posing special questions, for instance, with respect to the use of particular instruments for maltreatment or torture. These questions were answered by the witnesses objectively and not indiscriminately in the affirmative," unquote. Leading questions may, of course, suggest answers to the witnesses and thereby falsify their testimony, but the possibility of misconduct by examining officers does not necessarily cast doubt on the entire interrogation and its results. In the case of expert witnesses, the danger of leading questions hardly existed, since the examining judges lacked the necessary specialized knowledge and therefore left the formulation of the protocols to the witnesses themselves, as Eric Kuhr said of the deposition of Dr. Emil Stankeit, a medical officer. And this is what Judge Eric Kuhr said, quote, "This was obviously dictated by the medical officer directly to the clerk, since I could not pose many questions. From the use of technical language, it is clear that the doctor dictated it. The purpose of the deposition is that the doctor does not simply report his findings, but that he writes them down in the form of a legal document so as to give them more weight in subsequent investigations, particularly because of the oath. At the bottom of the deposition, you read that he took the oath both as witness and as expert, pursuant to paragraph 32 of the Regulations for Criminal Procedure in Wartime. Because he gave testimony not only as witness but also as medical expert, who was able to determine the nature of the wounds examined, especially whether they were mutilations, unquote. It was the practice of military judges to advise and instruct witnesses before each deposition, quote, of the subject matter of the questioning, of their duty to tell the truth, on the meaning of the oath, and on the criminal consequences of making false or reckless statements, unquote. Otto Mackel, a former judge, elucidated the steps in administering the oath as follows. Quote, as far as I remember, the oath ran thus. I swear by God, the Almighty and Omniscient, that I have said the pure truth and withheld nothing. So help me God. This formula was recited while raising the right hand with the three oath fingers. Thus, it is a genuine oath that was spoken after an admonition on the consequences of perjury. For this reason, I have no doubt whatever about the authenticity of this protocol that bears my signature, and also no doubt about the truth of the testimony of this lieutenant, unquote. In cases where a witness could report only hearsay, usually no oath was administered. It is said, quote, the deponent was not sworn because he did not himself witness the events, unquote. Judges did administer the oath in cases where the testimony contained personal observations as well as hearsay. More important, judges emphasized that they had only those witnesses take the oath whose testimony appeared truthful in every detail. In the course of verifying a deposition made 36 years before, Judge Wilhelm Landwehr explained, I would not have administered the oath to the witness if I had had the impression that they were not telling the truth, unquote. When the judge was familiar with the character of the witnesses, as was frequently the case with officers and doctors, it was unnecessary for him to take additional steps to verify their testimony. In all cases, however, military judges followed the rule that if the testimony was not plausible in every detail, the witness should not be sworn. Judge Geyer commented on a 1944 report sent to the Bureau, quote, I have refrained from swearing the witness because additional investigations appear to be necessary and the testimony is not entirely plausible, in particular with respect to the destruction of the tank. Sure, the deponent actually makes a good impression. He seems quite intelligent and is an alert and clearly thinking person. He did not contradict himself in any way in the course of testifying, and his statement was in all details understandable. Still, his judgment may be impulsive. He is also too convinced of his own importance. In judging his statement, one should take into account that he is only 17 years old. Unquote. The next section is headed Verification Through Multiple Witnesses. Because the administration of the oath cannot offer an absolute guarantee of the truth of the testimony, German military judges made an effort to question more than one witness for every case. In investigating the massacre of German prisoners in Branicki, four judges interrogated a total of 12 survivors and witnesses. Their testimony presented a complete picture of the events. There were only minor differences with respect to the estimated number of victims. The method of multiple depositions was also followed when the monitoring of enemy wireless transmission picked up information about enemy violations of the laws of war. Both the wireless operator and an interpreter or two operators were interrogated about the contents of the message. On 15 July 1943, for example, Judge Ernst Hartke took the deposition of wireless operator Robert Belinsky. He said, On 7 July 1943, I was assigned to the Communications Unit 282 with the duty to listen to enemy transmissions with a B wireless set. I had full command of the Russian language, and I translated the intercepted messages into German and sent them on. That was the end of his statement so far. Goes on, in order to check the accuracy of Bielinski's statement, a Russian prisoner of war who had been employed in radio transmission was also interrogated. He said, I was with Corporal Bielinski on 7 July 1943 and heard the intercepted messages. I wrote them down in Russian independently of Bielinski. Then they were translated into German. The content of the three messages has been read to me. It is correct. In all three messages, Red Army soldiers reported that they had liquidated German prisoners of war. That was the end of his statement, the Russian prisoner of war statement. The oath was administered to both witnesses. In a similar case, Judge Yanka of the 28th Army Corps interrogated a number of witnesses on 30 July 1944. Non-commissioned officer Edward Sandner stated, quote, on 27 July 1944 at 8:20 a.m., I heard part of a communication between two Russian officers. It said, I have a prisoner of war from Infantry Regiment 68 of the 23rd Infantry Division. The superior officer answered, don't make me any reports on prisoners of war. They should all be shot. I immediately wrote this statement down in Russian and gave it to our company commander, who also serves as translator. I have myself passed the translator's examination and certified that I correctly heard this transmission. Ludwig Kolb, Sandner's superior, confirmed the testimony. He said, on 27 July 1944, at 8:30, non-commissioned officer Sandner handed me an intercepted wireless message which he had written down in Russian. It said, I have a prisoner of war from Infantry Regiment 68 of the 23rd Infantry Division. Answer, don't make me any reports on prisoners of war. They should all be shot. Multiple depositions also helped discover errors and exaggerations. On 3rd September 1941, Sergeant Gerhard Steingreber stated, I did not see our wounded comrades burned with petroleum. I also never gave such a description to Sergeant Tonig. I did speak with Tonig after being wounded, but I know I did not tell him anything about the burning of our wounded by the Russians. There must be some sort of error or misunderstanding here. I may have been confused with another sergeant. Unquote. The next section is headed On-the-Spot Verification. One case that illustrates the care with which testimony was investigated is that of the medical orderly, Herbert Dietzel, whose testimony was taken by Judge Heinrich Arnold before the court of the 10th Armored Division on 14th January, 1944. The person of Dietzel, as well as his statements, has not left an impression of credibility or plausibility in all points. His former disciplinary superior, First Lieutenant Sheridan, was asked today for an evaluation of Dietzel, which he formulated as follows, and it's quite long. Quote, versatile, skillful, has a desire to dominate, deceiver, evasive under interrogation, always falling on all fours, tendency to exaggerate and falsify, lacking passion for truth, can organize well, adaptable, easily irritable, tendency to make up stories which his comrades do not believe. They rather laugh at his alleged experiences. Cunning, not a bad medical orderly, would not desert. Unquote. First, Lieutenant Sheridan gave this opinion before he was informed in detail of the matter under investigation. He also knew from hearsay that Dietzel had returned from Russian imprisonment. Dietzel's testimony was communicated to him subsequently. First Lieutenant Sheridan has expressed doubts with respect to the accuracy of Dietzel's statements. That's the end of that note. In view of these doubts, Dietzel's deposition, together with the judge's comments, were submitted to the division's intelligence department with the request that its personnel try to determine whether Dietzel had been taken prisoner by the Russians, whether he was witness to the shooting of German POWs, and whether he had been separated from his troop without being guilty of a punishable offense. The intelligence department was asked to specify whether the results in its investigations supported Dietzel's allegations that 5 German POWs had been executed by the Russians. Quote, "We can only make a report on this matter if it is absolutely certain that the 5 soldiers were shot as prisoners of war," unquote. The intelligence department interrogated a number of German soldiers and Russian prisoners of war and visited the village where the alleged shooting had taken place. Its report was then submitted to Judge Arnold, who forwarded the entire file to the War Crimes Bureau together with his comments. This is Judge Arnold's report. The statements made by Captain Sheila, commander of the Reserve Battalion 10, on 16 and 17 January, clearly established that Dietzel had in fact been taken prisoner, that Dietzel was the first man to come in contact with the Russians. Subsequent investigations eliminate the suspicion that Dietzel may have removed himself from his troop, so no military offense was committed. The reservations expressed in points 1 and 3 of my comments of 15 January 1944 with respect to Dietzel's credibility are therefore dropped. On 21 January 1944, Dietzel was sent for questioning by the intelligence officer of the 47th Armored Corps at his request. The Russian tank offensive was then reconstructed on location at Malaya Whiskey with the help of Dietzel, and in my presence, he was able to discard any doubt by positively identifying the location where the shootings had taken place. Dietzel further remembered a house where he had been treated humanely and kindly by Russian civilians. Dietzel pointed out several civilians who were then interrogated by our interpreter and who confirmed that they knew Dietzel, and they also made expressions of sincere joy upon Dietzel's entering their house wholly unexpectedly and upon their realizing that he had been liberated. The general impression emerging from the results of the investigations at Malaya Whiskey is that we can conclude that Dietzel appears to have spoken the truth, not only in substance, but also in all secondary details in his testimony of 14 January 1944. That's the end of Judge Arnold's statement. The Dietzel case was one of many in which an investigation was carried out on the spot. Of course, no such investigation was possible if witnesses and their troop contingent had been redeployed. Nevertheless, besides interrogating witnesses, many judges tried to see the evidence for themselves. Alphonse Waltzog had the opportunity to see a number of corpses of executed ethnic Germans in Poland in 1939. He said, "I even went to a Catholic monastery near Bromberg where Polish Catholic nuns live, interrogated several persons, and they showed me mutilated children's hands. I also saw mutilated corpses. As a judge, I had to take judicial view of corpses from time to time." That's the end of his comment. Judge Ulrich Schottenberg inspected a cellar with rubber-covered walls where reportedly people had been beaten. Outside in the courtyard, he saw fingernails that had been pulled off. This was against ethnic Germans, is what they said in the beginning here. Crimes committed against ethnic Germans in Poland in 1939. The next section is titled Follow-Up Verification. Even though its outcome remains unknown, the Dunkels case illustrates the care exercised by the War Crimes Bureau in pursuing the truth of allegations contained in the witness protocols it received. On 15 June 1942, a member of the Bureau's staff in Berlin, Karl Hoffmann, was sent to carry out routine interrogations at the Army Hospital in Frankfurt am Main. One of the witnesses he questioned was Corporal Hugo Donkels, who was convalescing from a serious grenade injury to his left shoulder. After Hoffman delivered the depositions, the Bureau found further checking necessary in a number of cases, including the Donkels statement. Therefore, Johannes Golcher wrote on 26 June 1942 to the Army Medical Inspector, quote, "Enclosed for your information is a transcript of sworn witness testimony on a raid by Russian partisans on a German field hospital in Roslau in December of 1941, during which some 120 wounded German soldiers, two doctors, and several nurses were allegedly killed. According to the sworn statement, the doctors and the nurses were Swiss citizens. Do you know of this raid? And do you have any proceedings that you could send us?" Unquote. On 6 July 1942, the Army Medical Inspector replied that he knew nothing about the raid. Meanwhile, the chief Army doctor in the high command pursued the matter further, and in late July received through channels a report of the chief medical officer of the 4th Army. It said, in December of 1941, Roslau lay in the rear zone of operations. No raids were made by either regular troops or partisans. The teams of Swiss surgeons assigned to the 4th Army under Captain Nicole was in Juchnow through 19th December 1941. They then moved on 20th December 1941 to Smolensk and arrived without suffering any loss. We find that the events described in the report are false and must be characterized as simply made up. Other army commands had no field hospitals at Roslau during the time in question. Unquote. That's the end of that exchange between the Bureau and the Army Medical Inspector. The chief army doctor thereupon returned the file to the Army Medical Inspector on 30th July 1942 with the comment, quote, "Corporal Donkels is apparently a psychopath, inclined to confabulation and pseudologia fantastica," unquote. The Bureau was not yet satisfied. On 16th August 1942, Maximilian Wagner turned to the Court of Division 159 at Frankfurt am Main, asking that Donkels be confronted with these statements and that the head doctor of the hospital in Frankfurt be asked for his opinion, quote, whether Donkels is a psychopath, or whether he could have imagined the happenings about which he reported as a result of delirium induced by his very severe wounds, unquote. But since Donkels had been transferred to Army Hospital Oberhof in Thuringia, it was not until 28 September 1942 that he was interrogated a second time by Judge Bates of the Court of Division 179 in Erfurt. Donkels was adamant, quote, "What I reported in my statement of 15 June 1942 corresponds to the events. I am convinced that there must be other witnesses who were there with me and who could confirm my testimony. Unfortunately, I cannot name any of these comrades because I never learned their names. I can only think that maybe I made a mistake in locating the events at Roslau since I went through quite a few hospitals and I was gravely wounded. As you may see from my paybook, I was in Army Hospitals 3/605 and 2/1, to which I was admitted on 10 December 1941. I was treated by a Swiss doctor. He was a captain and of small stature. It is out of the question that because of my wounds, I might have been in such a state of mind as to relate the experiences of other comrades as my own," unquote. Notwithstanding, the court of the 179th Division sent a request to Army Hospital Oberhof for an expert opinion on Donkel's mental condition and received a reply on 5th October 1942. It appears that Donkel's had lost much blood before arriving at the hospital, but was not suffering a high fever. Dr. Erich Koch, the physician treating Donkel's at Oberhof, reported, quote, "Retrospectively, I exclude the possibility of mental illness during the period in question. Organic injury of the brain, such as could have led to delirium or erroneous sense perception, must also be excluded, because otherwise Donkles could not remember so clearly the events he described. During his ambulant treatment, nothing occurred that would either support or detract from Donkles' credibility, unquote. On 6 October 1942, the chief medical officer of Army Hospital Oberhof endorsed Dr. Koch's opinion. He wrote, "During his hospital treatment from 27 July 1942 to today, Donkles has never given reason to believe he is mentally ill. According to Donkles' hospital record, he was transferred from the dressing station to Field Hospital 664 on 27 November 1941. He was then transferred on 29 November 1941 by ambulance to Field Hospital 651. From there, on 8 December 1941, to Army Hospital 3605. In his testimony, Donkles asserted that he had been transferred from the dressing station to Field Hospital 651. Since Donkles is not mentally ill, it must be determined whether the reported raid did not take place in Field Hospital 664, considering that Donkles stated in his deposition of 15 June 1942 that the raid had been at a field hospital. Furthermore, in the report of the Chief Medical Officer of the 4th Army, dated 20 July 1942, Field Hospital 664 is not mentioned, but only Field Hospital 622 and the Hospital for the Not Seriously Wounded, which is 4/591. That's the end of the Army officer's opinion. But in the meantime, a criminal investigation for perjury had been initiated by the court of the 409th Division in Frankfurt am Main. It turned for information to the court of the 179th Division in Erfurt, which on 9 October 1942 forwarded a transcript of Donkles' deposition together with the medical opinions. On 13 October, the court of the 409th Division sent the file to the Army High Command in Berlin. On the basis of these documents, the Bureau again requested the Army Medical Inspector on 21st October to recheck whether there had been any raids on field hospitals 664 or 651. Field Hospital 664 responded on 15th November 1942 that it had suffered no raid since its establishment, but that Field Hospital 260 in Ugotsky, Savod, had undergone a surprise attack on 24 November 1941. The records indicated that Donkles had not been under treatment in the Field Hospital 260 at the time of the raid, but that several survivors of the raid on Field Hospital 260 had been accepted at Field Hospital 651. The suspicion thus emerged, quote, that Donkles heard descriptions of the raid, which he later repeated as his own, without himself having been there, unquote. The War Crimes Bureau, however, in the course of evaluating all this material, encountered a number of contradictions, which it communicated to the Army Medical Inspector on 5 February 1943. For example, the chief medical officers of the 4th Army and the High Command had reported that the team of Swiss surgeons had never been employed at Roslau, yet Field Hospital 664 asserted that the Swiss surgeons had been in Roslau from 3 November 1941 to 18 January 1942 in Army Hospital 3/605. Quote, "It appears possible that Corporal Donkles was briefly accommodated in Army Hospital 3/605, which was set up in November 1941. Should this be the case, it would be necessary to determine whether this hospital was raided by Russian partisans in November or December 1941, unquote. On 26 March 1943, the overburdened Army medical inspector replied, quote, "The reports of the chief medical officer of the High Command and of the chief medical officer of the 4th Army indicate that neither Army Hospital 3/605 nor any other hospital in Roslau has been attacked. The Army Medical Inspector therefore declines to pursue this case further," unquote. In the meantime, Donkles, incapacitated by his grenade injuries, had received a medical discharge on 6th March 1943. His name then disappears from the available files, so that the case remains a mystery. Still, the persistence shown by the Bureau in pursuing this investigation, a persistence which, as other files demonstrate, was not unique, throws light on its concern, neither to take witness testimony on face value, nor to dismiss it without making every effort to verify it through other sources. That's the end of Chapter 5, and we will now go on to Chapter 6, which is titled Expert Medical Opinion. Many injuries can occur in battle, which a lay observer might erroneously assume to be deliberate mutilation. For example, wounds resulting from hand-to-hand combat, or truncations caused by fragmentation bombs or heavy shells. For this reason, the War Crimes Bureau required whenever possible that allegations of the torture or mutilation of German soldiers be investigated by the army doctors who accompanied the fighting troops. Heading for this section is Medical Investigations in the Field. Reports of mutilations were extremely rare in France, Belgium, and North Africa. But after the invasion of the Soviet Union on 22nd June 1941, such reports arrived almost daily. As a result, the Army decreed on 27 August 1941 that additional experts in forensic medicine would be assigned to the Eastern Front, quote, to examine whatever wounds or injuries are caused by the Bolsheviks as are outside the scope of legal warfare, unquote. A few weeks later, on 19 September 1941, General Kurt Reckmann, Chief of Staff of the German 9th Army, also ordered that experts in forensic medicine investigate all reports originating in his area of command. He said, quote, a brief description of the facts and precise location are imperative. Examination of corpses and autopsies have evidentiary value only so long as the corpses are fresh. The decomposition of the body may confuse the medical evidence and give rise to doubts and objections in foreign countries about what actually happened, unquote. Similarly, for the area under the 18th Army, the Chief Medical Officer issued a basic instruction dated 19 April 1942. Quote, the examination of corpses by medical officers must first determine whether the injuries in battle were deadly, whether mutilations were caused by means of military weapons or by other means, such as blunt instruments, and whether they were perpetrated on living persons or on corpses. For this, it is necessary to know the effect of the various weapons and munitions. Consideration must also be given to weather effects, damage caused by animals feeding on the corpse, and also decomposition, unquote. According to the available files, it is evident that German soldiers and doctors did not think first of mutilations when they encountered a wounded soldier or a heavily damaged corpse. In those areas where hand-to-hand combat was frequent, the observer usually explained wounds and mutilations as legitimate combat injuries. Dr. Walter Mühlerhoff, reporting on the examination of 20 corpses, stated, all injuries had one thing in common, namely that they were received in hand-to-hand combat. The bullets had partially burst open the scalp so that brain chunks had been spread around. Some bodies had been stabbed with a bayonet after death, as evidenced by the fact that no blood issued out of the wounds. Some bodies still had a knife stuck in the back. One corpse had stab wounds under both cheekbones, under the eyes. The eyes themselves were not injured. Sergeant von Bülow's clothing was ripped by shots and stabs around the abdomen. I saw no cut testicles or poked out eyes. Many witness depositions described wounds similarly. On 19 September 1942, non-commissioned officer Günther Blaub testified, I do not believe that the members of the patrol were deliberately mutilated by the Russians. The patrol was probably attacked with grenades and shot at. The men were wounded and attempted a retreat, during which a hand-to-hand struggle developed in which they were stabbed. This is how I explained the stab wounds. In many other cases, however, medical examination excluded that possibility. For instance, Dr. Sebastian Whitman reported on 13 August 1941. In my opinion, the injuries to these two corpses in the area of the face and forehead come from deliberate mutilation because, one, there are no indications that these wounds could have been caused by shrapnel or other shells, and the other head bones and skin are totally undamaged. Two, the derma was hardly torn but showed sharp edges indicating the use of sharp instruments. Three, there were no traces of gunpowder burns in the adjacent skin areas. I consider it out of the question that these injuries were the result of hand-to-hand combat, since such injuries run irregularly on the body. In my opinion, the bullet wounds I found had not been deadly. Hence, the wounded soldiers were subsequently mutilated when they were defenseless. And he says, with respect to a third corpse, the injuries of the tongue cannot be explained otherwise than as deliberate mutilation. Judging by the saturation of blood at the cuts, they were inflicted at the time when the soldier was still alive. There is no doubt about this. The next section is headed Injuries to the Eyes. It is difficult to determine whether eyes have been deliberately put out or whether the damage is attributable to decomposition, to drying up by the sun, or to the gnawing of rats or birds. An effort was made to have medical experts examine all such cases, but even doctors were not always able to tell. For instance, Dr. Richard Eckel and Dr. Herbert Siegmund were given the task of examining the corpses of three German Air Force officers who had been found shot to death at the military hospital in Lvov in Ukraine. On 4th July 1941, Dr. Eckel reported, quote, "It was impossible to prove whether the eyes of the German pilots had been poked out, since the corpses were so covered with worms that the loss of the eyes could also be explained as destruction caused by worms," unquote. But sometimes the victim did not die and could still be saved by the doctor who treated his eye injuries. On 13 August 1941, Judge Hans Georg Jeremias took the sworn deposition of medical officer and eye specialist Dr. Lothar Wetzlich. This deposition read as follows. "On 22nd July 1941, in the afternoon, I was called to the dressing station at Newell to treat a number of soldiers with eye injuries, among them Corporal Hans Mutt. As he had explained upon delivery at the dressing station, he had fallen into Russian hands around 9 a.m. He told me that he evidently had been dealt a blow to the head and that when he woke up he could not see anymore. He was very emotionally shaken and could not give me further details." The medical examination of the eyes rendered these findings. Right eye, a wound about 1 inch long could be seen on the lower rim of the eye socket going through the lid. Upon opening the eyelids, I discovered that the cornea and part of the lower derma evidently had been cut with a sharp instrument. The lens and the vitreous humor had flowed out. Left eye, the lids were undamaged. Upon opening the eyelid, I saw that the lower half of the derma as well as the cornea had been cut, apparently with a sharp instrument, and hung to the eyeball only at the top. Lens and vitreous humor had flowed out. The choroid membrane was exposed. In order to prevent infection and great pain, I removed the remains of the eyes. In my opinion, the injuries were inflicted with a shaving blade or a fragment from his shattered eyeglasses. Since the eyelids of the left eye were undamaged, they must have been held apart while cutting inside. Thus, it is impossible that the wound could have occurred in combat. End of deposition. In another case, Judge Eric Kuhr took the deposition of Dr. Emil Stankite on 15 August 1941. It reads as follows. "On 1st July 1941 at 5 a.m., I received an order from Regiment 208 to examine bodies of German soldiers said to be mutilated. Together with Dr. Wendler and with the medical orderly Müller, I went to the fortress Skomorochi and made there in the early hours the following examinations. Major Peter Schoengen, left eye socket empty, wound edges sharply cut. The jaw has been skinned from ear to ear with an even cut. The bones of the upper and lower mandibles are exposed. You know, it's like the Indians scalping people. The American Indian, my comment. Going on. Sergeant Major Peltzer, right eye put out, left eye heavily damaged, cause undetermined. Half of left ear separated by a semicircular cut from below. Wood splinters in the right eye indicate that the eye was poked out with a piece of wood. Corporal Clemens Schlagers, the corpse wears around the head, level with the nose, an 8-centimeter wide bandage without immediately evident reason, possibly an eye bandage that slipped. The left eye socket is empty. Cause undetermined, probably poked out. Sergeant Major Ernst Wegner, around the right eye a wound with sharp edges the size of the palm of the hand. The eye is missing. The bony eye socket is exposed. Non-commissioned Officer Lange, both eye sockets surrounded by even-edged cuts. The eyes hang out, stalked and in shreds. It could not be determined with certainty whether the mutilations were inflicted before or after death. The fact that in all cases heavy bleeding out of the eye sockets had occurred tends to support the supposition that the mutilations were inflicted before death. That's the end of that deposition. In an interview on 31st August 1976, Dr. Stankite further explained, quote, a bullet causes a more or less ragged wound, whereas if the eyes are cut out, this leaves more even edges. Explosives cause damage in all directions. A knife cuts a circle sharply and evenly through. To this extent, it is possible to discern by what means a wound has been inflicted, unquote. Injuries caused by mice or birds, he added, look entirely different. In another case, a Dr. S. described in a deposition dated 22nd November 1941 the condition of the corpse of Dr. Günther Reckert. Although the body had already started to decompose, I could identify it as that of Dr. Reichardt. I found the following injuries, which I believe were inflicted by the Russians before his death, since traces of blood were found on the body. Both eyes were poked out. The nose was cut off. Genitals were cut off. Unquote. In a letter dated April 7, 1978, Dr. S. gave further details. I was assigned together with Dr. Reichardt near Khorasan. A patrol was sent out to reconnoiter the strength of the Russian defenses. Dr. Reichardt joined the patrol. As the patrol leader later informed me, Dr. Reichardt went far ahead of the patrol on the road to K, initial K. Suddenly, Russians sprang out of the ditch on the left side of the road, grabbed Dr. Reichardt, and were gone before they could be effectively shot at. It was not possible to free Dr. Reichardt, since the enemy was very strong, but also because they quickly disappeared. On 24th August 1941, an Army information officer mentioned in passing that a dead German officer had been found and buried by his troop in the area of Khorasan. The regiment put a vehicle at my disposal. At the spot described, I found the grave and had it opened. It was the late Dr. Günther Reichardt. I recognized his thin reddish-blonde hair, the light Army fatigues with the ribbon of the Iron Cross, second class, and the unmistakable riding breeches with leather trimming. Boots were missing. The damage to the eyes, nose, and genitals was not a result of the process of decomposition. I found blood residue in all these parts. This explains the findings of my autopsy report. End of statement. At the end of May 1942, during the Battle of Kharkov, A military orderly named Tashin belonged to an anti-aircraft unit. About 400 yards from his position, a German fighter plane made an emergency landing in an area that was still in Russian hands. When Tashin was able to get to the plane a day later, he found the bodies of the 5-man crew. He said, "All bodies were naked with the exception of one that still wore the blue bathing trunks of our flyers. Their eyes had been put out. Quite evidently, this was a case of deliberate blinding, since there were no other facial injuries around the eyes. Four of the bodies were missing feet, and in some cases, hands. The places where separation had taken place were sharp, so that the members must have been severed with a sharp instrument, such as an axe. In my opinion, and the opinion of all comrades, these mutilations can only be attributable to the human hand. By no means could they have arisen as a result of the landing." Another corpse had a gaping wound in the abdomen around the groin, and the genitals had been cut off. I did not see any bullet wounds. Some witnesses testified to having seen Russians carry out mutilations. On 25th June 1942, Judge Lothar Schön took the deposition of Corporal Ernst Gottschalk. Quote, "We had to cover part of the forest and saw a wounded Russian soldier lying on a field. The medical orderly of the neighboring company went up to tend him. From a distance of about 300 meters, I saw the Russian suddenly take out his pistol and shoot the orderly. I then saw, as I was running toward the place, that the Russian dragged himself to the orderly and stabbed his eyes out with a dagger. When I arrived, the orderly was still alive, but he expired shortly afterward." Well, there's the reward of a good Samaritan. Next section is titled Genital Mutilations. From the early days of the Polish campaign and throughout the war years, reports reached the War Crimes Bureau purporting to describe mutilations to the genitals. Investigation determined that in a number of cases, soldiers had mistaken battle wounds for deliberate mutilations. Therefore, the Bureau again sought primarily the sworn testimony of competent medical officers. The consulting legal medical officer at the Army Medical Office issued a memorandum of 8 November 1941, emphasizing the necessity of careful verification. It reads, "Experience in Poland and elsewhere shows that lay witnesses and even doctors frequently err in this matter. Mere observation of a corpse is not sufficient to determine clearly whether the genitals are missing. Frequently, witnesses jumped to this conclusion merely on the basis of the presence of blood or blood-colored putrid fluid in the genital area. If indeed the genital organs are missing, then several possibilities must be checked. For instance, that the loss was not a result of destruction by worms or a bullet injury. The same considerations apply to alleged mutilations of the female breast, which in repeated instances in Poland turned out to be the result of the exit of bullets." Going on, a typical case of erroneous reporting was uncovered by Dr. Gerhard Panning in Yugoslavia, where he had been sent to investigate such allegations by the troops. On 16 October 1941, Dr. Panning submitted a medical opinion stating that the medical investigation carried out by a Dr. Grosser on 4 October 1941 had correctly concluded that the alleged mutilations corresponded to erroneous observations by laymen who had only seen that the genital area of Corporal Lütkers was very bloody. The blood had issued, however, from wounds on the upper thighs, and the presence of the undamaged genitals was established by photograph. In many other cases, however, medical investigation did confirm deliberate mutilation. On 20 August 1941, the medical officer of Infantry Regiment 239 stated under oath that, quote, "Private Bist did not die as a result of the bullet through the thigh, but rather bled to death from the amputation of his testicles," unquote. In a medical report dated 4 July 1941, That's also just a little over a week since the beginning of the invasion. Dr. Hans Jacob Matern described the corpse of Corporal Dorr, whose skull had been bashed in. Quote, "In the area of his genitals, I discovered 10-centimeter incisions, which indicated that the enemy had attempted to cut off his genitals after having pulled down his pants. The left eye had been poked out of its socket. According to my medical findings, the bullet wound in his chest was not the cause of death. Dorr had been incapacitated by this chest wound. It appears that the Russians took advantage of his defenseless state to beat him to death and sadistically abuse him," unquote. In yet another example, Dr. K.G. testified on 13 March, 1943, quote, "The penis appeared to have been removed by a clean cut. The medical officer of this fighting unit, Major Count von der Schulenburg, remembered Schultz well since he had dressed his thigh wound one day before. At that time, there was no injury of the genital organs." So this is the kind of savagery that Adolf Hitler warned his military officers about. And we have to remember, too, that the Soviet Union was not a signatory of the Hague Convention. And yet the Wehrmacht wanted to treat everything according to the Hague Convention and simply go through all the process of reporting all these crimes against their men, rather than go ahead and execute as many of these types of partisans as they managed to do in order to prevent so much of it from happening. That's the way I look at it. Experts in forensic medicine is the next heading. The War Crimes Bureau made it a practice to submit reports dealing with mutilations, together with photographs and other documents, to the consulting medical officers at the Army Medical Office for routine verification. The following examples illustrate the cooperation between the two agencies. Dr. Arthur Jorst was attached to Field Hospital 125 during the Battle of Uman near Cherkasy in the summer of 1942. On a path in the forest, he found 7 dead German soldiers lying in a row. In a sworn deposition taken before the Court of Division 405, Dr. Jorst declared, "Each soldier had his own knife sticking out of his skull. The skull caps showed fist-sized holes out of which blood and brain parts had spilled. Under the head of each soldier, a helmet had been shoved. This must have been done after the soldiers were already dead, since there was blood under the helmets. In my opinion, the soldiers were still alive when the knives were driven through their skulls. A corpse would not have bled in this fashion unless the wounds were inflicted immediately after death." As consulting medical officer, Dr. Panning commented, quote, "The interpretation of the witness is erroneous. The correct explanation of the event must be sought rather on the assumption that the 7 soldiers were killed by shots from behind at the nape of the neck, thus causing large exits in the skull cap." That's where the fist-sized holes were. "And that then their own knives were stuck in the gaping holes. Judging by the witness's own description of the circumstances, that a helmet had been subsequently placed under the neck of each corpse, and that the corpses had been laid in rank and file, this case appears to be an example of sadism upon corpses. Such ignominious treatment of corpses, evidently executed with a view toward the impression that would be made on the discoverer, is not infrequent in our experience," end quote. A second example may be found in the investigations of the discovery of 2 mass graves in the village of Besipetowka in July 1942. Lieutenant Lennartz, the company commander, explained that in the second grave, unlike the first, "We discovered that bestial tortures had been inflicted on 56 comrades we found. Most of the corpses were in uniform, or at least half-dressed. Only a single corpse was naked, that of Major Schoenberg. There is no doubt that Major Schoenberg was beaten up terribly, since his whole body was streaked with blood. The medical orderly, Ernst Rosten, examined the body very carefully in the presence of numerous witnesses. He did not ascertain any wounds or entry or exit of bullets, so it may be concluded that Major Schoenberg was beaten to death. Both feet of another corpse had been separated at the ankle joint, apparently cut by a scalpel or similar instrument. This can never have occurred as a result of an injury, since both feet exhibited the same kind of incision. Three corpses still had their hands shackled behind their backs. End of that statement. Dr. Panning's comments on the description of Major Schoenberg's body began with its blood-streaked appearance. Quote, decomposition causes, among other things, deep red to reddish-black coloring of the skin and of adjoining tissues, which can be distinguished from bleeding as a result of outside influences only by the expert. Yet considering the special circumstances of this case, the evidentiary value of the observations does increase. The grave provided conditions similar to those in a refrigerator, as evidenced by the presence of snow and ice remnants in the excavation in midsummer. We know from experience that corpses buried in very cold weather are better preserved than corpses buried in warmer weather. He went on to address other details. He said, quote, a medical investigation, and especially one for the purposes of medical jurisprudence, should also have determined whether the injuries of the individual persons could have been fatal. A medical orderly did examine the naked corpses for wounds. A deadly bullet or stab wound, which certainly would have been recognizable in view of the good state of preservation already described, could not be found. The assumption that Major Schoenberg was beaten to death is not vulnerable to criticism by enemy propaganda. It is well known that a beating, even without injuring internal organs, may well prove fatal by causing an embolism. In the case of Major Schoenberg, it appears that his torso was subjected to blows of insufficient force to injure visceral organs. The assumption of the witnesses that Major Schoenberg's facial expression and mouth position indicated that he had screamed from pain is not persuasive. The corpse's mimicry is worthless, even shortly after death, as evidence of the final sensations, since it depends on coincidental internal and external factors such as rigor mortis, subsequent dislocation as a result of external pressure, or tugging in the grave, loss of fluids or accumulation of gases. Nevertheless, this error of interpretation does not detract from the importance of the case. Next section is headed Guidelines of the Army Medical Inspector. In an effort to eliminate as many errors as possible, the Department of Science and Promotion of Health in the Army Medical Office issued on 12 June 1942 special guidelines for making medical findings. The following excerpts indicate some of the problems. This is a long guideline. I quote, in the course of examining materials on enemy atrocities and violations of international law, which were submitted by the legal department of the Wehrmacht for review by experts in forensic medicine, many erroneous findings on the part of lay observers were found, as well as erroneous interpretations on the part of medical doctors, as could be seen on photographs supplied. It is sufficiently well known that in murder investigations, one must expect a certain percentage of erroneous statements by witnesses. There are many different causes of these errors. Erroneous statements occur frequently in cases involving mass murder, such as in cases here dealt with. In particular, we must point to the following typical changes that medical officers have frequently failed to take into account. In judging these cases, we will refer to the extensive empirical evidence collected by this Bureau in the course of investigating the murders that occurred in Poland, where similar assumptions by laypersons and doctors could be verified by autopsy in a number of cases. In the frequently reported cases of extensive destruction of the skull, both lay witnesses and medical officers have almost without exception supposed that the destruction had been caused by blows with rifle butts, shovels, or hatchets. Practically at no time have the medical officers stopped to consider the hydrodynamic effect of a rifle bullet fired at the skull. This is perhaps understandable, because this type of immediately fatal wound never arises in the daily work of the therapeutic doctor. In any event, it may be generally said that the reported findings on completely destroyed skulls with brains splattered out cannot be explained as having been brought about by the application of blunt force by hand. Certainly such destruction was caused by a bullet or bullets. According to general empirical evidence collected by practitioners of forensic medicine, blunt force can cause this type of destruction only when it reaches the magnitude of machine injury, for example, in an automobile accident or of a fall from a great height. The kind of complete destruction involved in these findings cannot be brought about by blows with belts, rifle butts, or axes, which, according to experience, cannot alter the structure of the human skull so completely. End of that. Then, the guidelines go on to insist that in examining eye injuries and suspected mutilations of the tongue or of the genital organs, the doctor should always take into account other possible explanations for the destruction or removal of tissue or body organs, genuine military injuries, decomposition of the body, or damage caused by animals. The conclusion emphasized the importance of careful medical investigation and reporting. It reads, part of it reads, in view of the extreme cruelty practiced by the Soviets on wounded as well as unwounded prisoners and also on ethnic minorities in their own territory, some persons may at first think it is unimportant to correctly reconstruct the procedure employed in the individual case, or that it is immaterial whether the destruction of the skull was caused by a bullet or by blows with a rifle butt. The reaction of the foreign press to our publications on the atrocity murders in Poland showed, however, that foreign public opinion understandably relies on examination of our allegations by their experts, who would, of course, not fail to detect gross errors such as those described above. Just to take one case as example, it would be easy for an enemy expert to poke fun at the allegation that a Soviet star had been branded on a body. The substance of the matter, namely the fact that the person killed had been shackled, that is, that he was a prisoner and that he had been murdered with a shot at close range, would appear in the light of the other allegations equally incredible. Therefore, it appears necessary to remind all medical officers responsible for writing such reports of a fundamental rule of forensic medicine, to lay down a clear statement of the findings to which any reasoning about the use of a particular instrument shall be added, if at all, together with essential critical reservations. Only then will the medical report achieve its rightful place in the vital investigation of violations of international law. End of that. Since the files of the Army Medical Inspector are very incomplete, it is no longer possible to determine to what extent these guidelines were in fact observed in subsequent years. The records of the War Crimes Bureau do show that witness depositions dealing with mutilations were regularly submitted to the Army Medical Inspector for routine review, and that the Bureau relied on the judgment of forensic medicine experts to separate erroneous allegations from those that correctly described mutilation in violation of international law. Well, that's the end of Chapter 6. And notice that he's always mentioning, never fails to mention, in violation of international law. And this is kind of interesting. This should be realized in relation to what I said earlier, that in the Soviet Union, they did not pay any attention to the international laws of war. They were not signatories to the Hague Convention. And yet, always we're talking here about violating international law. And the fact is that there was no international law being respected on one side there, on the Russian side, so there's no way that you can be respecting international law when the other party is not doing so and have it be what you'd call a fair fight. So ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of this program. I'm now going on to chapters 7 and 8 in the next program, so I hope you will be with me then. This is Carolyn Yeager on June 29, 2015, signing off with the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau reading. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.